This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman.
Well, Barack Obama takes another primary, and perhaps another one to come. We'll see. Things are rolling along. By the way, greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is Monday, the 10th of March. 9 o'clock in the morning Pacific time, noon Eastern time. We are live, and as soon as I get off the air here today, I will be hopping on an airplane heading off to ultimately about a day and a half from now, two and a half days from now, I'll be in southern Sudan in the Darfur region. And we will be doing our show live from their satellite phone, God's willing, on Friday of this week. Brink Lindsey is with us right now. He's the vice president of the Libertarian Cato Institute. And he's also the author of a new book, The Age of Abundance, How Prosperity Transformed America's Politics and Culture, and Why the Culture Wars Made Us More Libertarian. Brink Lindsey, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
I find the premise of your book fascinating. I'm a big fan, first of all, of Maslow and his work. I thought your second chapter that kicks right off with Maslow's hierarchy of human needs, a fascinating one. You know, this whole concept of humanist psychology and this threshold right above safety and security and that kind of thing. But
yes.
But it seems that you're you know, you're using Karl Marx and his categories. I suppose you could call that. I think you called it ironic. But isn't the argument that you're making in this book defeating itself? Actually, rather than my trying to lay out your argument, let me just let you lay out your you know, give the elevator speech for the book in a minute or two, and then I'll give you my.
So the book is a social history of the United States since World War II, looking at how the arrival of mass prosperity in the years after World War II transformed our culture and our politics.
For the first time in our history since the 1760s, really.
What's that?
For the first time in our history since the 1760s.
Well, I think the U.S. in the post-World War II era was something new under the sun. It was the first large society in human history where most people weren't poor, where most people weren't directly exposed to the vagaries of nature for their basic material needs. And this had astonishing and tumultuous cultural and social and ideological consequences. And you referred to Abraham Maslow, the famous psychologist who posited this hierarchy of needs that you've got that, you know, if you're if you survival and stability come first, if you don't have those, you can't think about anything else. But if you've got those in the bag and you can take them for granted, you start worrying about whether you've got friends and whether you're loved, whether you're standing in your community. Once you've taken care of those, there's still something. There's something at the apex of the pyramid.
Yeah, self-actualization is what
Maslow
called.
Self-actualization. And in my telling, America in the 1950s had gotten off the base of Maslow's pyramid. Safety, security, survival could be taken for granted. You've got a generation, the baby boomers, the first generation in human history, born taking provision of their basic material needs completely for granted. And so they started gunning for self-realization, and all kinds of social movements, from civil rights movement to feminism to environmentalism to hedonism, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, all of those, I think, were predicated upon the basis of mass abundance, that people didn't stop worrying once they had their bellies full. They started worrying about new things, and they found old cultural taboos and restrictions too confining, and so we got the rollicking.
And you see this as a bad thing? You see this as a bad thing?
I see this as a good thing.
Okay.
I think
so if this is a good thing, here's the essential question then. And by the way, I would submit to you that your book could have been written, and I'm sure you're sufficiently familiar with Burke's writings to, you know, that to some extent he did write your book back in the 1780s and 1790s when he was arguing with Thomas Paine, because there was that kind of prosperity in the United States from the 1740s through the 1790s, and or arguably up through 1800 and and made arguably after the 1820s. And what did it produce? It produced the exact same thing, social ferment that led directly to a revolution, which Burke saw as a horrible thing. And so we've had two eras in the United States history where there was a large, substantial, politically active middle class, that being in the late 1700s and in the late 1900s, or the mid-1900s. But
in between, industrialization gave us a big whopping.
Right. In between, we had terrible poverty. But in between was the time when we were most libertarian. And what brought about this prosperity, you know, the first prosperity in the late 1700s was brought about by and large by the theft of property from Native Americans and slavery. So we can kind of set that aside. That's not one thing we're going to replicate.
Right.
But the prosperity of the mid-20th century was brought about not by libertarian policies, but by the antithesis of them. It was brought about by FDR's New Deal. It was brought about by minimum wage laws. It was brought about by unionization, the Wagner Act. It was brought about by widespread education, particularly higher education, with the GI Bill. As you talk about in your book, millions, you know, you talk about how, you know, all the people who were going to college, it was absolutely unprecedented. And it seems to me like that's a repudiation of libertarianism.
Can I agree with you just a little bit here? Absolutely. A number of the policies you talk about helped to spread the wealth around more widely than it otherwise would have been spread. And in some of those respects, I think in a very healthy kind of way. Spreading the wealth around and creating it are two different things.
But it was created during...
Unions didn't create wealth. The New Deal taking money from Peter and giving it to Paul didn't create wealth. It redistributed wealth. The wealth had to be created, and it was created by the dynamic forces of market capitalism.
I strongly disagree. I would argue that those New Deal policies did create wealth because by giving workers a say in the workplace and by having government intervene in the marketplace and say, no, there is a maximum 40-hour work week, and you will pay a minimum wage, what they did was they put more money in the average person's pocket, which generated demand, which created opportunities for entrepreneurs like you and me, which then created wealth.
What we know is that according to the most kind of union-friendly statistics, people in unionized industries make about 15% more than people in non-unionized industries.
But if those unions had never existed...
And yet per capita income has gone up many-fold over the course of the 20th century. So you're talking about a little marginal difference versus a whopping difference.
No. Let's revisit the history of unionism then, because there essentially wasn't a union... cohort until the 1930s, until the Wagner Act. It wasn't substantial. And from the 1930s until the 1970s, you had a very strong union cohort. You had 35% at its peak of the American workforce unionized.
And during that period, labor's overall share of total income didn't change any. It didn't change.
No,
it didn't
change. That was the period of time when working people's income exploded. That was the period of time when the income of average working people exploded. And then in the late 70s and early 80s, when Reagan declared war on working people and on unions, and unions have slid down to the point now where they're only 7% of the private workforce, we've seen an absolute stagnation in the wages of working people. So I would say that there's a clear correlation between unionization and the increase in wages of people, which then drives the creation of wealth.
Well, the stats don't really bury out, Tom, because as I said, the labor's share of total income has been more or less stable over this entire period. So it's true that unionized workers made more because of collective bargaining. But what did that do? That meant that there was less employment in unionized industries than there otherwise would have been because their wages were driven up.
That's
which
right.
meant that workers that would have worked in those industries went to non-unionized industries where they knocked down prevailing wage rates.
No. Brink, in your own book, you point out that in 1900...
The only reason unionism works, the kind of Wagner Act unionism that you seem to be championing, the only reason it works is because you have industries with high profit margins and they can skim some of it off and give it to the workers.
No, it works...
But it doesn't work in an era of globalization.
No, it works... I'm agreeing with you that it works by...
The only way we can be rich is with unions, then we're doomed.
Now, I'm agreeing with you, Brink, that it works by limiting the labor pool. You, in your own book, point out that in 1900, before we had strong unions, that there were 1.75 million children between the ages of 10 and 15,
a fifth of all children who were in the workforce,
and they provided a third of all the incomes for working class families.
Absolutely.
Children.
I think this is something that that one of the main points I want to get across to people is just how good we have it today compared to the way our grandparents lived.
As a result of unions.
No!
It was the unions who fought for the child labor laws because they saw children as competition in the labor market.
Per capita GDP back then was paltry. There wasn't enough wealth to go around. There was only enough for a few people to live.
Because there wasn't enough income in working people's pockets.
We're past that now. Even though real incomes for less skilled workers in particular have been stagnating in recent years and have been growing much more slowly than for better educated, more highly skilled people in recent years, still their living standards today are much higher than they were in the 1970s. Nobody would want to go back in time to a time before computers, before CAT scans, before ATMs, before cheap cruise vacation.
Before working at Walmart instead of working at GM?
Life's a lot better now.
Okay, Brink, we got to wrap it up. The Age of Abundance is the book. Brink Lindsey's the author. Check it out. Brink, thanks a lot for being with us. Cato.org.
Wipe your hands, shake it off, and you stand.
21 minutes past the hour. Hey, good news from out of Darfur, actually, where I'm flying to this afternoon. Actually, a day after tomorrow, I'll be arriving there. We're going via Europe. But global pressure, this is from Agence France-Presse. And Mia Farrow posted this on her home webpage, miafarrow.org. She was on our show last week. She just came back from Darfur, and there's an amazing collection of photographs. She's turned it into they've got some kind of cool little software on her website where it just takes you, you know, with photo through photo, with descriptions and everything. If you just go to miafarrow.org and click on photos in the upper right-hand corner. In any case, she has posted there this Agence France-Presse article, Dateline Beijing. Global pressure on China over its ties to Sudan has spurred the Chinese government to take a more proactive stance on ending violence in Darfur, the nation's special envoy on the issue said Friday. The Chinese diplomat Liu Guizhong told journalists, Darfur is the focus of international attention, and many Western nations want China to play a bigger role. That's why I have been appointed as a special envoy of the Chinese government on the Darfur issue. This is great because, China has a big stick in that area. They buy most of the oil out of that region. And they're doing much of the oil development in Sudan and southern Sudan and the Darfur region. And so hopefully they'll become a force for the positive, for the good. Back to the issue of our first guest. And he's not here to defend himself, so I'm not going to take on Brink or his book. But just this larger issue, in my opinion, what we saw was the creation of wealth in the United States, the dramatic creation of wealth in the United States across the board. We've seen the creation of wealth pretty steadily, continuously, since the founding of this country, arguably since about 100 years before the founding of this country. And I think you could probably graph it as a fairly linear line, at least up until World War I or up until the turn of the century. But the wealth really wasn't widely distributed until after the New Deal. And I would argue that that's when the linear line started really becoming a spike upwards, and it came about as a result of demand from the middle class, and the middle class was created by Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal policies. And now over the last 30 years, we've seen these New Deal policies being attacked continuously, you know, over and over and over again by the Bush administration, you know, trying to take these things apart. I mean, you know, basically, it seems like that's what they're all about.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yep, back in your box, Rush. So, I mean, that's what we're seeing, is that for 30 years now, we've had a war on the middle class, essentially. We've had a war on the New Deal. And the New Deal brought us this vast middle class prosperity that, in my opinion, brought about the prosperity of the United States. And because we have been, over the last 30 years, hollowing out the middle class and taking the wealth of the middle class, which was mostly stored in their homes, and taking the income of the middle class, which was driving and feeding that wealth, and redirecting that income to the CEOs. CEOs are now making 500-600 times more than average workers instead of 30 times what they were in the 1950s and 60s and 70s. And people no longer own their homes. You know, when my father died last year, he owned his home. He had paid off the 30-year mortgage, and that was the norm for his generation. And now it's like, you know, how much money can we get out of this house before we sell it and flip it? Right? Everybody, you know, the household debt is now at levels that we haven't seen since World War II, since the end of the Great Depression. And the consequence of this is that we've had an economy that has shifted from doing things, making things, actually creating wealth, to an economy which is, you know, I give money to Louise, she gives money to Sean, Sean gives money to me, I give money to Louise, and it just goes around in a circle like that, and nothing gets produced. And because all the production is being done in China, or in Mexico, or in Vietnam, or, you know, fill in the blank of the developing nations around the world. And the consequences of this are dramatic. Two articles in today's Financial Times, the first by Wolfgang Munchau. This is an op-ed piece. And the headline is, Central Banks Cannot Stop This Contagion. And he notes, in its September 2007 Global Stability Report, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, provided a useful hypothetical example of how a small fall in asset prices can easily wipe out an investor. And then he goes on to talk about how, because of margin calls, if a hedge fund invests in $100 in with a 15% margin requirement, that's fine. They're borrowing $85 from the bank. But then the bank says, okay, we want an additional 5%. You know, if it drops in value by 5%, we want an additional 5% in equity. So the fund has to start liquidating its assets. And the bottom line is they end up with, you know, $36 out of that 100 that they started out with. And this could be a disaster if this kind of scenario plays out. Then you go to the news section of today's Financial Times, and there's a headline, Credit Derivatives Turmoil Bites. In other words, basically saying that this nightmare scenario that Wolfgang Munchau is hypothesizing on the editorial page of the Financial Times is at our door. They had the first paragraph, turmoil in the credit derivatives market is having an increasingly brutal impact on the wider financial system as a vicious cycle of forced selling drives risk premiums on company debt to new highs. Many investors fear that conditions could worsen as hedge funds, banks, and other financial institutions come under pressure to cut their losses. Are we on the edge of another Republican Great Depression? 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Well, I took a walk around the world to ease my troubled mind.
No, there's a lot we can do. I mean, that's the bottom line. Welcome back. Tom Hartman Radio Program brought to you by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors, the local sponsors that you hear on your local station. Let them know you're listening. Our national sponsors. And the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199 fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Just a couple quick bits of news here, and then we're going to pick up some phone calls. Our number, 866-303-2270, by the way, tomhartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room, airamerica.com for the blogs over there. The House Judiciary Committee has filed suit, this is from the Associated Press, to force former White House counsel Harriet Myers and White House Chief of Staff Josh Bolton to provide information about the firing of U.S. attorneys. Finally, the bizarreness of this, the tragedy of this, is that the House Judiciary Committee is having to sue because the Department of Justice, Michael Mukasey's Department of Justice, the agency within the federal government that is given the responsibility of enforcing the laws made by Congress, is refusing to enforce the contempt citation that Congress passed. This, in my opinion, should lead to an impeachment of Mukasey. But that, you know, that's probably not going to happen. So what has the House done? Well, the Judiciary Committee has now gone to the federal courts to sue. And John Conyers says he's confident that the federal courts will agree that the immunity is at odds with constitutional principles. In other words, they're trying to, and this is going to have to go to the Supreme Court, and the Bushies are just going to, you know, run the clock out. Oh, yeah, is it constitutional or not? We'll debate that, you know, and it's going to go up through the, you know, through the, I'm assuming this is in the First Circuit that it's being filed in Washington, D.C., and then it'll go to the full circuit, and then it'll go to the Supreme Court, and then the Supreme Court will decide whether or not it's constitutional. And by that time, Bush will be gone. By the way, last week, last Thursday or Friday, we had Bill Foster on the program. He's running for Denny Hastert's seat, Democrat, Chicago. He won. Good on you, Bill. Congratulations to Bill Foster. And it's absolutely great that, that he did that. 1-866-303-2270. Our number, Judy in Northfield, Massachusetts, listening on WHMP. Hey, Judy.
Hi. I'm a first-time caller. I'm reading David K. Johnston's book, Free Lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just outraged at how we've been systematically destroyed in our middle class, and never mind the poverty level is just awful.
Right. For him, for our listeners who aren't familiar with what you're talking about, his book is essentially about how the laws have been changed and lobbyists have taken over and corporations are getting a free ride and the people have inherited wealth and large corporate powers are skimming all the cream out of the economy and we're left with a very watery gruel.
Yeah, and the way it's going, it looks like we're going to lose 40 million more jobs. I mean, it's just it's just obscene. So I'm now retired, and I want to do something, and I want to be effective. And I went to the last chapter because I was getting so depressed, and he's suggesting having legislators have their expenses paid for by the population, where they have to defend what they do. Well, that's okay. I can see that. But I don't, as an individual person, I want to know what I can do to organize, to help. I have lots of energy, and I want to make some difference here. So,
what we need to do is a very simple two-step process, Judy, is number one, we need to educate Americans about what the New Deal was, that you know, before Franklin Roosevelt came along, before the New Deal came along, before unions came along, there was no 40-hour work week. There was, you know, as our guest, as Brink Lindsey points out in his book, in 1900, a third of all family income in the United States came from children working in the workplace, literally working in the workplace, and sometimes working 60, 70, and 80-hour weeks. And this is the consequence. This vast middle class that we enjoyed from the 1940s until the 1980s was the direct consequence of Franklin Roosevelt pushing through things like in 1935 the Wagner Act, which gave people the absolute right to unionize, which has been now eroded severely since the Reagan administration. And now we even have a Department of Labor, which is supposed to advocate for labor, which is hostile to labor, is helping corporations bust unions. That we need to understand what the New Deal was all about, and then those people who do understand it and who do understand, you know, the basics of economics, getting involved with the Democratic Party and taking it over from within. So I, you know, my suggestion to you would be to show up at your local Democratic Party precinct and volunteer and get involved and start pushing for candidates who are progressives. We're seeing here in Portland, you know, just a whole variety of people coming out running for office, and it's really quite startling to me how many are really truly progressive and how many are kind of DLC light. You know, they're what would have been called Republicans during the Eisenhower administration. They're kind of Eisenhower Democrats, and increasingly the people are saying we'll take the real progressives. And so that would be my advice to you, Judy, and I've got to move along, but those are the steps that we need to take. I just don't see any other way. Larry, we need to take the party back to take the country back. Larry in Los Angeles. Hey, Larry.
Yes.
You're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Hey.
Reason I'm calling, I tragically and painfully, I agree with you completely. And anybody who will listen to me, I tell them, it's basically, but it's over. And I think that by Election Day, I don't think the Democrats have to worry about McCain or anybody else, because I think by Election Day, the economy is going to be black.
I have a feeling it's going to happen in the first 3 months after the election. I think that these guys are going to be able to pull together enough spit and bubble gum and rubber bands that they can hold it together until November, or whatever the date of the election is this year.
I disagree with you because from my point of view, and I'm not an economist or anything like that. I'm 65 years old. I just pay attention. The economy, to me, blew apart in August.
Yeah.
And since August, they have spent more than $3 trillion doing what you're talking about.
Well, it was September, you'll recall, the first week of September on this program when I said, "This, go back and look, this week is the beginning of the Great Depression."
Okay. Yeah, because I know you've said you don't like to come out and talk about it a lot because people, like when I tell it to people out when I'm talking, they say, "Oh, you're so negative." Well, it's not like I'm making it happen.
Yeah, it's like, hey, wait a minute, it's raining outside. No, it's not. You're being negative. You know, no, it's raining outside. And so, therefore, put on a raincoat, get an umbrella, you know, let's fix the roof, the leaks in the roof. I mean, there are just, you know, simple things that you do when it's raining. There's simple things that you do when you got a depression coming. There's some things you can do to minimize how severe it's going to be, and the Bush administration's doing none of them.
Well,
and there are things that you can do to recover from it, and that's going to require a Democratic administration, because only Democrats have demonstrated that they know how to get us out of a depression.
Oh, yeah, they've done that, but I do, like I say, we disagree on that one. I think that it will be black long before then, because, you know, we lost 60-some thousand jobs was the last month.
Yes.
The jobs are all
right. Well, see, Larry, if you're right, it will be a good thing for the Democratic Party, tragically, because everybody will see that 30 years of Republican rule, and I put Clinton's administration right in the middle of that because, by and large, on economic policy, he was carrying on, you know, Reaganomics.
Yes.
And so, with the exception of balancing the budget, which the Republicans played a large role in. And so 30 years of Republican rule, 30 years of Reaganomics has destroyed the American economy, and everybody's going to get it. And Rush Limbaugh's, you know, will take a little clip from what I just said and say, see, the Democrats are hoping for the economy to crash. No, what I'm pointing out is that the political, the economic policies of the Republican Party and of conservatives have destroyed the infrastructure of America. They have hollowed out our economy. We no longer make things here anymore.
Everything about America that I love and that is good to me is gone. All of it. Whole ball of wax. And also, I think that a year from now, when the new when the Democrats take over, they're going to be in a state of shock because for the first time, they're going to be looking at the books.
They're going to be exactly, and they're going to be starting from scratch, and it's going to be like FDR in 32, and hopefully we will have. And thank you, Larry, for the call and for pointing that out. Hopefully, we will have a president who is as charismatic and forceful and willing to make change and willing to say, okay, guys, this is what we're going to do, damn it, whether you like it or not, as we had in FDR. Phil in Akron, Ohio. Hey, Phil.
Yeah, how are you? I want to say thank you for appealing to the intellect of us average people, because it really comes off as common sense. And I just want to call and say about the guest you had on, you kept on emphasizing aggregate demand, and he just seemed to blow right past that.
Yeah, although I didn't use that phrase, because mostly economists understand that and the average person doesn't. I just said, you know, money in the average working person's pocket, which is what aggregate demand is.
Yeah, I've learned it by reading those two Ravi Batra books that you had him on, and I thought they were great, the Greenspan book and the Golden Age, and plus your book, Screwed, I got that too. And it just comes down to such common sense that if people can't buy things, there's no sense in companies expanding and increasing productivity when they can't buy it. I've explained it to my sister, and she goes,
And see, here's the amazing thing, Phil, is that the average American in the 1950s knew that.
Yeah.
And the average American today doesn't know that.
Well,
and
that's what she said, excuse me, Phil, your concepts are too deep. I said, I heard on your show Eisenhower explaining the military-industrial complex. I said, how come that generation understood concepts like the military-industrial?
Right, they got it. I mean, they saw it actually happen in their own lifetimes. They figured it out. And we've had is Reagan talking about the Laffler curve and all this kind of nonsense. And, you know, let's just trickle-down economics. Phil, thanks a lot for the call. Trickle-down economics, don't worry. And then David Stockman comes out and writes a book saying, you know, yeah, I was economic advisor and I was wrong. Oops, I'm sorry. Not enough, David. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our infrastructure's eroding, so what if levees break? For disasters, we're not ready. Bush things will just eat cake. 'cause a dollar is his true God. The people he'll forsake, business will carry on. Glory, glory, Halliburton. Glory, glory, Halliburton. Glory, glory, Halliburton. Business will carry on.
I just got a letter here from John Conyers and Patrick Leahy. I'm not the only one. I mean, if you're on either one of their email lists, you got it. And it's from their campaign staff. I mean, this isn't something that came out of the out of Congress. And, you know, as the chairman of the U.S. House and U.S. Senate Judiciary Committees tasked with modernizing the FISA Act, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, we are working hard in Congress to pass a FISA bill that protects our national securities, et cetera, et cetera. And basically, they're asking us to be active right now. Please write a letter to the editor. And they have put together a website, fixfisa.com. And they're asking people to click through that and send an email to their friends and call their member of Congress. So check it out. Fix, www.fixfisa, F-I-X-F-I-S-A.com. And presumably there, I've got to go check out the website here, and I'll do it during the next break. I'm looking at the letter right now. John Conyers and Pat Leahy, you can access them via that route. John in Ithaca, New York. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hi, John. Tom, I know you're going to Darfur. I sent you some stuff. I hope you got it by FedEx. What's on my mind right now is to...
Yes, thank you.
Beg you to ask the right kinds of questions when you're there. Nobody who's visited there has really treated the Darfuris as people with political opinions. There are things who have political goals. Nobody's asked them what they think the relationship of Darfur should be to Khartoum, to the capital. Nobody's asked them about whether they think a federal state should be the outcome. Nobody's asked them whether they really want a united region because Khartoum divided up Darfur and so forth into three provinces so they could control it better. Nobody's asked them about what their opinions are about their supposed leaders or the prominent leaders of the opposition as well. So, John, I hope you'll ask.
I will. John, I assure you I will be asking as many questions as I can. And there's going to be several of us on this trip. We will, if the satellite phone gods willing, we will be doing the show Friday live from Darfur by satellite phone. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is bringing three of them along. And because she's in the past had one fail on her, and we're going to be in an area where there is no water, there is no electricity, there are no buildings, there are miles. We're talking about an area about half the size of Texas where there's only 10 miles of road and millions of people and no hotels, no running water, no electricity, no commerce, no stores, no nothing. And we're going to be flying in a cargo plane onto a dirt strip. There's no airport. It's just a big flat area that's been cleared for the plane to land. And then by truck taking stuff out into various communities around there, hoping to avoid areas where there are still landmines. And because there's no roads. But we'll see. I'll give you the whole report on Friday. Everything I know right now is just hearsay, so I can tell you. I'll tell you what I saw and where I am on Friday. Julie in Seattle. Hey, Julie.
Hi.
Hi.
I don't get to listen all the time. I'm homesick today, so I'm listening. Uh-huh. You've been saying about a coming depression, and I have to tell you that I've been saying this for months, and people are calling me paranoid, and even my own husband, because I wanted to do things like change our money to euros. I wanted to put our, food storage in the garage for our family. And, people are thinking I'm paranoid, but I just read a book recently. It was called The Worst Hard Time, and it was about the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. And I'm reading it. I was so stunned by the parallels between what was happening at that time and what's happening now. And, when I look at it, even an impending man-made climate crisis that people want to deny, even that was happening.
The Great Dust Bowl.
one of the things that really frustrates me is because I'm a teacher, is that we don't educate our kids about history. One of the things that's really falling off the map is social studies, and that's because that's one of the things that's not tested. When we have here in Washington the Washington Assessment of Student Learning, the WASL, we don't test for social studies. And so we're not educating kids about all of the hard work that went into building this nation.
That's right. And you know why? Because during the 1980s, this campaign that is that David Horowitz is continuing right now on our college campuses of trying to root out all the socialist professors. In the 1980s, during the Reagan administration, that campaign was, let's get the socialist textbooks out of the schools. Let's get the socialist unionized teachers to stop promoting Marxism and socialism. And all that was code words for, let's stop teaching the history of the labor movement. And they succeeded. You will not find any significant coverage of the history of the labor movement in today's modern social studies books. And it was there in the 70s and 60s and 50s. It was there when I went to school. It was not there when my children went to school. I noticed the difference. I remember, you know, the right-wing talk show host going off on it in the late 70s and the early 80s, you know, Limbaugh and whatnot. And that's what happened. Julie, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Tom in Brattleboro, Vermont. Hey, you guys passed the contempt, arrests of Cheney and Bush, didn't you?
Absolutely.
Hey, good on you, and thanks for listening on WKVT there. We have about a half a minute before we got to take a break. You wanted to promote an idea?
Well, I'll be real quick. As you already mentioned, Pelosi and Conyers have decided to pursue a civil lawsuit to force Bolton and Myers to appear.
Mm-hmm.
Too little, too late.
Yeah, they should be using inherent contempt, like John
Dean
suggests.
That's exactly what I was trying to say.
Yeah, yeah. Inherent contempt is arguably a constitutional premise where they can simply. But the problem is that they would have to send the sergeant at arms of the House of Representatives out to make the arrest. And the question is, can that person go all the way to Texas to arrest somebody? And or would that be considered, you know, in the context of inherent contempt, a violation of the, was it 9th or 10th Amendment? I think the 9th Amendment, that all rights devolve to the states. Would it be, you know, would that be the federal government overreaching? And that would end up before the Supreme Court. So it's a tough one either way. 57 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
So how have the Democrats created poverty in America? Al Perinello runs a website, PreserveTheAmericanDream.com, characterizes himself as a proud millionaire. And he's concerned that the Democrats are trying to do for the poor. Well, they're trying to make us all poor. Right, Al?
Sort of, kind of. Yeah, Tom. How are you?
Fine. So I don't get this. I'm a little confused. How is it that the Democratic Party, which brought us the great middle class of the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and you know, which was, I think we can all say, was an incredible time of expansion and of wealth in the United States. And then since the 80s, under Republican policies, Reaganomics, we've seen wages absolutely flat. And the disemboweling of the American economy under Republican policies. How is it that the Democrats are trying to promote poverty?
Well, let's see. Where do we begin? First of all, you know, I think the premise that you put forth is highly questionable. But we can get into that in a little bit. Right now, I can tell you that, you know, I was born in a little town on the other side of New York City called Hoboken, New Jersey. I was born and lived the first 22 years of my life there. And it is, in fact, a gigantic Democrat hotbed. It is a machine, a Democratic machine, Hudson County, New Jersey. And as a small kid, I watched very, I guess, you know, from the back row, I just sort of took a look at how my family was functioning. We were poor, and we had a lot of relatives who were poor, and that's what I was born into, and that's what I lived through. And I watched something.
What does poor mean?
I'm sorry?
What does poor mean?
What does poor mean? Well, you know, in my case, it meant, you know, having Campbell's soup for dinner for myself and my three brothers many, many times.
Yeah, I remember, you know, when I was growing up, I remember three straight weeks where we had macaroni and cheese for dinner every night because it had been on sale. But, you know, still my dad was working in a tool and die shop. He had four boys. I was the oldest of four boys. We, mm-hmm. you know, the six of us, you know, we grew up in a three-bedroom house.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought of myself as poor, though. I mean, looking back on it now, I see that we were the top end of the working poor, or the lower end of the middle class, but
I think that's true.
It didn't feel that way to me as a kid.
And you know what? It never does. It never does, because when you're dealing with it, you don't know the alternatives.
In fact, I thought we were doing pretty well.
Yeah. Well,
life
was
good.
good, and
I'm just curious if that was the case, or if you were, you know, living like Dennis Kucinich. I mean, they lived in a car for part of the time when he was a little kid.
We lived in a cold water flat. We lived with no extras whatsoever. Nothing worked. My father's car kept falling apart. He was a mechanic, self-employed, made enough money to bring us camel soup and occasionally, you know, a hunk of meat for dinner. And to me, now, back then, you know, I was having a happy life. I was playing, you know, stickball and kick the can and stuff like that in the streets
right,
of Hoboken.
So here we are. So why
right.
would,
now,
you know...
Now
so,
that I look back, I can say, wow, were we poor based on what I've been able to...
But neither one of us was experiencing the misery of the Republican Great Depression. Neither one of us was experiencing the misery of the time when Republicans ran this country, for example, in 1900, when a third of all children were providing more than a quarter of all family income in the United States.
Uh-huh.
I mean, those were really bad, and that's, I'm quoting from the Cato Institute, the libertarian think tank.
Right.
Those were really bad times when the Republicans were in charge. The Democrats brought us unionization and a solid minimum wage and the middle class. How is it that you can say that the Democrats are trying to destroy prosperity?
Well, I think the Democrats gave America the most poverty-oriented program that ever existed. And
Lyndon Johnson cut poverty in half in 4 years.
Why are you always talking in history? Why don't we talk about today?
Okay,
you know,
you've got,
I mean,
you know, you want to talk about, for example, your barroom economics over on your website, preservetheamericandream.com? Is that
right.
the... Okay.
Right. Well, did you...
Toss it up.
Did you read it?
Yeah.
Okay, so what?
So why don't you go through it for my listeners real quick, if you want, and maybe you can just summarize it very quickly, and I'll give you my response to it.
I missed the point, Tom. What are you asking me to do?
The barroom economics thing.
Oh,
that
I'm sorry.
You've got on your blog.
Well, essentially, it's a common man's understanding of how economics work and how the tax system works. And what is so terribly wrong about the tax system? And without, you know, going into verbatim, essentially it's the somebody is going to be paying an enormous amount of taxes in this society. Somebody. And today, you know, that can be, frankly, called the top 1% or even the top 10%. Because the top 1% right now of this, you know, economy in this country are paying 37% of all the income taxes.
But they own 80% of all the wealth.
No.
In your barroom economics example, the question is, okay, what happens with that last guy?
Right.
The thing is, in the very beginning, you're assuming that everybody's drinking the exact same amount of booze and has the exact same amount of space around them in the bar. In reality, if you were to proportionate to their wealth, the rich guy would have 80-some-odd percent of the bar. The poorest guys would be in the hallway to the men's room. They would be drinking out of thimbles. Mm. They'd be drinking their beer out of thimbles. He'd be drinking his beer out of a keg.
And in the case that's set forth, they're drinking for free. They're drinking for free because the guy...
Out of the thimbles in the hallway to the men's room. Right. Yeah, out of thimbles in the hallway to the men's room because this little bit is dripping down to them. Right.
Well,
but,
Tom, you know, you and I really don't, we probably, you know, will never agree on, you know, on the pain that is suffered by wealthy people in America. But I got to tell you, when 1% is paying 37% of all the taxes and 10% is paying 70% of all the taxes, you have to begin to think that if we continue to punish people who do well in America, they are going to find alternatives. And by the way, if you go to preservetheamericandream.com, you will see bar economics, and you'll see that it has everything to back up essentially what I am saying.
Right. And I would suggest that it has everything to back up what I was saying. And I encourage people to go there, preservetheamericandream.com, and check it out. Al, you just said that taxation is punishment, and this is something that really baffles me.
No, what I said was taxation is punishment.
If multimillionaires are using the commons, I mean, here we've got court systems that preserve wealth. We've got the federal banking system that preserves wealth. This is all paid for by us. This is the commons. We've got this broad commons that allows the accumulation of wealth. Somebody has to be paying for that, and if the people who are using it are not paying for it, then everybody else is going to have to. It just seems to me quite reasonable that somebody who has enormous wealth also is paying enormous taxes, at least in proportion to their wealth, so that because they're using the commons that created that wealth.
You know, Tom, if you put a period at the end of your sentence right there, you make some sort of sense. The problem is you can't put a period at the end of your sentence because liberal thinkers about dollars in America never seem to understand. And that is that there's more to it. The bottom line is, look, right now, let me go finish my scale, because we're talking about 10% of those people who work in America are paying 70% of all of the taxes.
And own about 85% of all the wealth in this country, and have around 80% of all the income in this country. And they're not actually paying 80% of the taxes. They're paying 80% of the income taxes. When you look at the bottom wage earners in this country with sales taxes, property taxes, and FICA taxes, they're paying a much higher tax rate than the very wealthiest in this country. And then you've got all these people like George W. Bush who are primarily living off passive income. They're living off dividends and interest, and their maximum tax rate is 15%.
You know what? You should try it. It works. It's a good thing. It's not a bad thing.
Yeah, life is good for rich people in America.
Well, then become one, Tom, because your listeners and anybody listening to us.
So, Al, if we have 300 million people in America, if all 300 million people become millionaires, who's going to do the work?
Well, let me tell you something, Tom. You're talking to this kid who was born into poverty, drinking Campbell's soup, who became a millionaire. So, am I the enemy? Am I a...
Who's going to do the work, Al, if everybody becomes the leisure class?
Say it again, please.
If everybody becomes the leisure class, who's going to build the cars? Who's going to sweep the streets? Who's going to teach the kids? Who's going to police the streets? Who's going to be our firemen? Who is going to be the American middle class if everybody becomes millionaires?
You know, that's the beautiful thing about capitalism. You know, somebody, you know, the inherent...
We'll always find some sucker.
the vice of capitalism is that it's an unequal sharing of blessings. But the virtue of socialism is that it's an equal sharing of miseries. What choice would you like to have?
It's a false choice, in my opinion. PreserveTheAmericanDream.com. People can make up their own mind. Al, thanks a lot for dropping by.
Always
Al,
good, Tom. Have
Al,
a good one.
Al Perinelli, 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, brother, I can't get through. I've been trying hard to reach you, 'cause I don't know what to do.
Well, it is, and that's what the cons are up to. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Now, let's check out what's going on in Iraq for a moment here.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lives in the balance.
Speaking of children at the cannons, this from the Interpress Service News Agency, Dar Jamail writing, The United Nations has estimated that half a million Iraqi children died during the 12 years of economic sanctions that preceded the U.S. invasion of March 2003, primarily as a result of malnutrition or disease. But childhood malnutrition in Iraq has increased since then by 9%, according to a new Oxfam report. A Save the Children report shows Iraq continues to have the highest mortality rate for children under 5 in the world. Since the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, this has increased 150%. 1 in 8 children in Iraq dies before their 5th birthday. 122,000 children died in 2005 alone. According to the UN Children's Fund report, at least 2 million Iraqi children lack adequate nutrition, and the World Food Program's insecurity assessment of food insecurity in 2006 said they also face a range of other threats, including interrupted education, lack of immunization, and diarrheal diseases. The numbers are alarming, said Vice President of the Iraqi Families Association, Omar Khalif. He said there's an increase of about 20% in reported cases of missing children over the past year. 17% of Iraqi children are permanently out of school. An estimated 200,000 more are missing. 760,000 children out of primary school in the year 2006. And those are just the in-country figures. That doesn't count the 2.5 million Iraqis who have fled their country with their children. Only as of this moment, according to the UN Children's Fund, only 40% of children nationwide in Iraq have access to safe drinking water, and only 20% of people outside Baghdad have a working sewage system. You tell me that's the way it should be. I don't think so. And John McCain wants 100 more years of this? And that qualifies him to be president? That's the kind of, he's got a lot of experience, you know? He's experienced, and therefore he's qualified to be president. Because he likes this war, and he'd like 100 more years of it. Doesn't wash for me. Karen in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
I can, and thank you for listening on KPOJ. What's up?
Oh, I listen a lot, and thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to talk to you. I just wanted to pick up on a thread from the barroom economics conversation.
Yeah.
Well, it has to do with, let's look at the metaphor that you raised about the thimble, people who are middle class drinking out of the thimble,
right,
and then the people who are wealthy drinking out of the beer keg. And that distribution metaphor only portrays half of what's going on, because the other half, of course, is how is wealth produced?
Right. In other words, those guys who are drinking out of the thimble are the ones who are, after, when they're not drinking, they're running around in the back room making the beer.
Yes,
and the guy with the keg, who has 80% of the entire room all to himself, which is not in this barroom economics email that everybody has seen by now, I think. The one really wealthy guy in the room, who's sitting with 80% of the room and 30 kegs of beer in front of himself, is producing absolutely nothing.
Right. I think.
And God forbid he should have to pay taxes.
Right. And I think it's frightening for people to hear the production argument, because in John Edwards' run for the presidency, just mentioning the fact that there might be some implicit worth in the working and middle class was divisive, right? That was considered divisive. And if we raise the specter of production and who's actually doing all the work, it's frightening in this country, and we're called all sorts of names.
Yeah.
And I think gradually we have to keep introducing this perspective in a gentle way. I mean, I don't want war. I don't want class war, and I don't want a civil war. And yet we also have to be aware of what's happening, just look at the commons as something that's outside of that whole production system, something that's partly inside of it, too.
You're right. And the commons, and you know, using, for example, the publicly paid-for educated workforce, using the publicly paid-for roads, using the publicly paid-for rights of way and the commons. Yeah, absolutely. Richard in New Jersey, we got about a half a minute before this break. What's up?
Hello?
Hey, Richard.
Yeah, just a quick point. I couldn't get over his pity the poor rich.
Yeah, pity the wealthy. His pain of the wealthy.
I'm going to set up a fund. It's pity the wealthy, and I picked my recipient for my fund. It's me.
Okay. Are you one of the wealthy who needs pity?
No, I want to be one of the wealthy. So you
I
need
see.
Pity.
Okay. Right. Yeah. Let's have pity for these poor rich guys. These poor multimillionaires. Richard, thank you for the call. Life must be tough when you're just sitting on 20, 30 million bucks, 100 million, 300 million, 500 million, a billion, I don't know. Bill Frist's daddy, $4 or $5 million that he made from privatizing the health care system. Life is just really, really tough for these guys. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Let's talk about the radio. Sing the only songs you know. You can feel it in your very soul when you listen to the radio. Torn by dark side in the sun.
34 minutes past the hour here on the radio. Welcome back. And as I say, strange news out there in the wire services. On a day when millions of Americans were reeling from the news that there were trace amounts of prescription drugs in their drinking water, President George W. Bush made a stunning announcement at the White House. "I am responsible for this," Mr. Bush told reporters. "This is my idea for a prescription drug plan." Standing before a banner reading "Prescription Accomplished," the president said that he hoped providing Americans with free medications via their tap water would prove to be the finest legacy of his administration. Mr. Bush indicated that America's drug-laced waters could boost tourism in the U.S., adding that English rocker Pete Doherty was getting on the next plane over here. Across the country, the announcement that President Bush had doped America's drinking water with dozens of prescription medications drew a variety of reactions. The pitching great Roger Clemens said, "It makes me proud to be an American." Reacting to the news that she had been imbibing anti-anxiety drugs in her water, New York resident Carol Fowler said, "I'm not worried about it, but come to think of it, I'm not worried about anything anymore." But Atlanta's Tracy Kulgian said he believes all drinking water in the U.S. should come with a warning label indicating possible side effects. He said, "I had a glass of water yesterday, and I had an erection lasting more than 4 hours." Yeah, strange stuff. And a tip of the hat to Andy Borowitz, of course, the author of this. You can find it over at BorowitzReport.com. Tongue planted firmly in cheek. 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number. George in Los Angeles. Hey, George, welcome to the program.
You know, the thing is that this guy that you had on the air doesn't know what he's talking about. Because Warren Buffett says that his secretary makes more money than him, and Warren Buffett's worth about approximately
$30 million. His secretary pays more taxes than him.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
As a percentage of her
more
income.
More taxes than he does.
Right.
And the fact is that if Rockefeller were to call, had a problem, he called the FBI, they knock on his door, and they say, "What can we do for you?" If the middle class person has a problem, he calls the police, and in a couple of days they might come by and they want to know what's happening. But the difference is that the use of the commons. When you are influential, it's like the book, Free Lunch. People that are worth millions and billions of dollars are getting free money from the government when they're privatizing different projects, the government can use that money, whether it's $90 million or $400 million or $800 million that's mentioned in the book. They could use the money and do it themselves. It's absurd that the middle class has to support the upper class, the 1% of the population controls approximately 90% of the wealth of this country, and it's at the backs of the middle class. And you look at the tax structure.
No, you're absolutely right, George. And the reason why is because we've had, since the 70s, you had Joe Coors and a couple of other very, very wealthy guys got together and said, how do we protect our wealth? How do we create a kleptocracy? How do we create a small governing elite and essentially take over the government of the United States? And they funded a series of think tanks, and they funded a number of politicians, and that became what is known as the modern conservative movement. And they have hijacked public policy. They have hijacked public discourse. They have hijacked the media, and they've hijacked the way that most Americans think, to the point now where even Democrats have to say, "Oh, I'm not going to raise your taxes," like it's some sort of reflexive thing. Hey, wait a minute. I don't mind paying more taxes if I don't have to buy health insurance, for example. I mean, I don't mind paying the gasoline tax if it means that I don't, every time I go on a public street, I don't have to drop 25 cents into a toll booth. there's always going to be this trade-off. Do you want some corporation providing all this stuff, or do you want to provide it through the government? Those are the choices, because we can't do it for ourselves individually. I can't go out and build a road from where I work to where I live. This is the commons, as George so correctly pointed out. Mike in Michigan. Hey, Mike. You're on the air, Mike.
Yes, sir. Great show as usual. What people have to realize is the abhorrence of class warfare. This has been going on for even beyond, not to say that Coors and those people didn't profoundly make it more effective, but this war has been going on since day one.
Oh, yeah.
And the little guy is being slaughtered out here. In
yep.
Michigan, it's madness. They need to tax according to net worth as opposed to income.
Yeah, now that's something that actually the founders debated and Jefferson wrote about at some length, because there are, in England to this day, there are taxes based on what you own rather than what you earn. And so there's a tax based on your net worth, and that, at least I think it is to this day, it certainly was back in that day. And in this country, we ultimately decided that we would tax by and large based on what we earn and what we buy. That's sales tax and income taxes. And the only extent to which we would tax people on what they own was on property. And that really kind of got slipped in, the property tax, as a way of increasing taxes on the middle class, as the middle class became, you know, as ownership of property became more broadly distributed across the United States. You had Republicans and conservatives all across the country pushing for income tax, for property taxes, and to have local government funded by property taxes, and you know, so to distribute the pain more evenly. Yeah, right. Phil in Pinebrook, New Jersey. Hey, Phil.
Yeah, hi, Tom. My one benefit of being retired is I can listen to you for 3 hours every day.
Right.
Tom, I have a very modest proposal. It's simply this. Let everybody in this country, every working person who earns $10 an hour or less, let them stage a general strike without exception for 1 month. At the end of that month, let's sit down and talk about tax policy, health care, and a whole host of other issues.
Yeah, because everything would be shut down. It's people forget, you know, the Ralph Cramdons of the world. Yeah, good point, Phil. Thank you very much. Alan in St. Louis. Hey, Alan.
Yeah, Tom. I didn't catch, when you were interviewing this guy, I didn't catch what unit he was in the service. But what about the disabled vets? He said anybody can go out there and become a millionaire. Well, what about us disabled vets that aren't able to work anymore? You know, I got a whole $20 raise this year because of inflation was being low and everything. And
but you've got to have some compassion, Alan, for the poor millionaires. I mean, they're being taxed.
Yeah.
You know, we've got to have compassion for these people because the taxes are just making them crazy. They're waking up in the middle of the night frightened that their taxes, I mean, right now they're paying a maximum income tax rate of 15% on dividend and interest income. And if we go back to the way it mostly was throughout most of the history of this country, they might have to pay the same income tax as you and me.
Gosh, man, what wonders will never cease.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks,
point made, Alan. Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I mean, it's incredible. Ed in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ.
Oh,
hey, Ed.
You know, we treat the rich like little furry sea babies, you know.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
I was calling actually because going back to what you were talking about earlier, that once we get the Bush gang out, the Republican brand name will probably be worthless for a generation. And the thing that we need to understand about that is that the big money interests who back Bush are still going to be around, and they're just going to find another avenue to express their agenda, namely the Democratic Party. And so they already have.
That effort was called the Democratic Leadership Council,
that's
the
exactly
DLC.
Right. That was, you anticipated what I was going to say, which is that we have a fight for the election this November, but once the November election's over, the real fight begins, which is going to be to contain the DLC within the Democratic Party to keep it from controlling the agenda. And the way to do that is to start at the grassroots and take the states back, state party organizations one by one back, until we're ready to actually take out the DLC elements in Washington.
Yep. And I would say, actually, it begins at the county level.
Absolutely.
At the precincts and the counties.
And that means everybody listening, you got to get in. You got to get in now.
That's right. Join up. Start, you know, show up, join up, and participate. Very well said, Ed. Thank you very much. Ruth in Manhattan. Hey, Ruth.
Hi, Tom. I just want to repeat something that A.J. Liebling published in a New Yorker article, I suspect in the 60s, but it might have been earlier in the 50s, but I've never forgotten it. And that is the way that labor disputes are reported in the media.
Mm-hmm.
You never hear that a labor union is offering to work for $7 an hour, but management is demanding that they work for $5. The verbs are always reversed.
You're right. You're absolutely right. That, you know, the other bizarre one that just continuously mystifies me is this thing of creating jobs. Nobody creates jobs. You know, I have started a number of businesses. I've employed upward of 100 people, a couple hundred people, I suppose, in aggregate over my lifetime. And I never created a job. What I did is I went out and I found people to do things for me or my company, that I could pay them less than they were creating in wealth. So if they could generate $30 an hour worth of value, I could pay them $20 an hour and I could make 10 bucks. I mean, you know, the bottom line is people don't create jobs. They hire people to generate wealth for them.
Right.
And then they skim that wealth off the top. I mean, that's what employers do. And it's like, oh, we need to give some big tax breaks to these guys so they'll create jobs. God, they don't create jobs. They're using people to generate wealth. Well, it's a fine thing. We're all agreeing it's an okay thing under appropriate conditions if the pay is right. But your point that it is never said in the newspaper that labor is offering to work for this amount and management is demanding that they take less. Instead, it's always said management is offering a certain amount and labor is demanding more. That's you're spot on, Ruth. Thank you so much for educating me about that. I appreciate that. Much appreciated. Hang on just a second there. Mark, I'm going to put you back on hold. 45 minutes past. I didn't see that break coming. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Running on Robitussin today. We'll be back right after this break. Stick around.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Not alone. I never thought I'd find the road to freedom. Never thought I'd see you smile again. Never thought I'd have the chance to tell you that I will always be your friend.
Oh, that's sweet. 9 minutes before the hour. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, which, along with Talkers Magazine, is co-sponsoring this trip to Darfur. Ellen is going along with me, or I'm going along with Ellen, actually, I guess is the right way to say it. And Ellen, you will always be my friend, Ellen, and you are already in Switzerland?
I am, with Rusty Humphreys. A couple quick things. First, let's related to Darfur and the Sudan situation. Congressman Frank Wolf, a Republican from Virginia, wants to ban any federal officials from attending the Chinese Olympics, and he wants to include the president in that, and so that no federal money can be spent getting to the Olympics because of the Chinese position in Darfur. One other interesting note is just a few minutes ago, the president issued a memorandum for the Secretary of State saying that there was unexpected urgent refugees and migration needs related to Kenya, where you and I will be on Wednesday. And he wants there to be national interest, he said, to furnish assistance under an act of the U.S. Congress to not exceed $4.5 million in emergency refugee and migration assistance. Not exactly a lot of money, considering we spend $12 billion a month in the Iraq situation.
But it's a start. Let me just toss something into that, if I may, Ellen.
Sure.
Mia Farrow was on our show last week. She just got back from Darfur, and she's got some just heartbreaking pictures over at miafarrow.org, and actually a very good overview of the area. She did a very thorough job. And on her website is a story from Agence France-Presse about how the Chinese, yesterday or the day before, have appointed a special representative who his only responsibility is to deal with Darfur and to try to stabilize the situation there. And they're doing this in response to world public opinion. I think the Steven Spielberg thing really stung them, and they want to be part of the solution, not part of the problem. And I think that that's very good news. It'll be interesting to
hear. It is good news, and I believe the special representative, according to the European press, is on his way to France right now.
Right, and so it'll be very interesting when you and I get to the south of Sudan, to southern Sudan, to find out if that's being translated into action on the ground or not. And whether, you know, Nick Kristof, he was on the show last week, and he was there 3 weeks ago, and some of the areas that we're in fact, last night talking to John, just about 30 miles from where we're going to be, is where the army from the north was apparently bombing aid stations, you know, as a way of trying to drive the aid folks out of there, presumably so there wouldn't be reporting of genocide. And hopefully that, you know, a stop will be put to that before you and I arrive.
Absolutely. So hopefully it will be. There's just so much other news that's going on. Today, our staff went to the American Foreign Policy Council meeting, and Jim Woolsey was talking, former CIA director under the Clintons, and he said that, well, they're moving away from the Cold War way of thinking. But then he said the ideology, this is the scary thing, that controls Iran should be taken as seriously as Hitler. And he recommended stronger sanctions on Iran and also a need to reach out, this calls for the CIA, I think, to reach out to the citizens of Iran.
Right. Well, I've had Jim Woolsey on this program, and we've discussed this. He's essentially in favor of our invading Iran tomorrow morning.
Right, exactly.
And he was one of the big, major voices back in the late 90s in favor of our invading Iraq tomorrow morning, you know, starting back in 1998. I think he was one of the co-signatories to the Project for a New American Century, wasn't he?
I believe so. Two other really fast things. Byron Dorgan says that KBR, Kellogg Brown and Root, then a division of Halliburton, has actually given the troops chlorinated old water, and they used it for showers. Some of them got waterborne illnesses, of which you are an expert at understanding.
I've had a few in my day.
I know.
In the third world.
And the other thing is, U.S. House of Representatives filed a lawsuit through their general counsel and the House Judiciary Committee to enforce subpoenas, and they are saying that there are no grounds for executive privilege.
Now, it seems to me like this lawsuit, it's just going to go to the, I'm assuming, the First District in Washington, D.C., and then it'll get kicked to the Supreme Court, and then next year the Supreme Court will decide on it, which means that the Bushies are just going to run out the clock on this, isn't it?
Well, yes, they're going to run out the clock, but even if there's a new Congress, then it does, and you have a different president, how are they going to call executive privilege? I mean, you can still do so under the Presidential Records Act, but the question is whether a new president can almost override it in some respects, or
right,
Congress will override it. Big, big question. And meanwhile, also Senators Leahy and Representative Chairman Conyers has asked their constituency to send letters to the editor on FISA. Ask their just normal citizens to do that.
Right. They've got a great website. It's called fixfisa.com. And you can go there and plug in your zip code, and it'll give you your local newspapers, and you can click the box, and you can write a letter to the editor and just push send, and it gets sent from you, from your email address, to that local newspaper at fixfisa.com. It's a really nice little tool. So we have just about a minute left, Ellen. Any news from Europe or Africa that you want to talk about?
The interesting part about Africa is that a friend of yours and mine, who shall remain nameless, gave me the name of probably one of the wealthiest men in Khartoum, and asked us if we wanted to contact him. So I contacted our folks here and said, well, what should I do? And they said, whatever you do, do not give them our schedule, because if they're at all politically connected, we don't want anybody to really have our particular schedule for our own safety issues. So there is a little bit of that going on.
Take our schedule off my website then.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good idea.
Yeah. Okay. Actually, the details of our schedule are not on the website, so.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Ellen, thank you very much.
Thank you. We will talk to you and see you tomorrow.
I'm on a plane in 3 hours, and I will see you in Zurich tomorrow afternoon.
You got it.
Okay. 57 minutes. Ellen Ratner, TalkReadyNews.com. 57 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're in the Democracy Zone.
Democracy Zone.
Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
The Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. So in our first 2 hours of our program today, we've been talking about how the middle class has been systematically hollowed out and destroyed as the New Deal has been rolled back, as Limbaugh's, you know, great dream that Roosevelt is dead.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yeah. And they've had some successes. We've had 30 years, more or less, of pretty much uninterrupted destruction of the New Deal. And nobody has rolled back Taft-Hartley, for that matter. The proposals put forward by Truman in 47 for a national single-payer health care program were never put into place. I mean, and on it goes. And unionization is down. How do we... So we've documented this over the first 2 hours. How do we pull together a progressive majority that can actually win elections? Robert Creamer's on the line with us. He's the author of a new book, the foreword by Tom Matzie of MoveOn.org. Listen to your mother. Stand up straight. How progressives can win. Robert, welcome to the program. Robert Creamer? He should be there. Okay. All righty. Well, we'll find out what happened to Robert. Anyway, and this is, frankly, I think the question of the day is how do we take these things back? I mean, it's step by step. It's a good start is by contacting members of Congress, by getting involved in the political process. Hey, the trucker in Washington on 1090 AM. Hey, trucker, welcome to the program.
Howdy. I just wanted to add my 2 cents worth on this thing about the commons.
Mm-hmm.
And the taxing of the privatization of natural resource is probably head and shoulders above everything else in the regard to unearned income.
In other words, somebody drilling an oil well on their property, they're tapping into a pool that probably covers an area that's hundreds of miles in diameter, but it happens to be on their square acre. They make all the money on that oil, and really the oil arguably isn't even theirs. It's the property of the nation. Many countries say that resources deep under the ground are actually part of the commons. Is that what you're talking about?
You took the words right out of my mouth.
Okay, good.
Very good.
So your suggestion is what?
Well, my suggestion is that we learn to distinguish between earned and unearned income.
Right.
And look at go to Wikipedia and look at economic rent.
Yeah, I agree. And we learn to distinguish between the commons and the not commons. Excellent point. Thanks a lot, Trucker, for the call. Let's try Robert Creamer again. Hey, Robert.
Tom, I'm right here. Are you there?
Okay, I am, indeed.
Good.
We now have a phone line that's working. I thought for a minute there Alberto Gonzalez was,
It would be possible.
Or indeed. Mukasey, I guess, these days. So you've written this new book, Listen to Your Mother, Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. How can progressives win?
Well, first, I think you're absolutely right that for the last 30 years we've been on the political defensive. And the question is, how do we both create a replicable political majority electorally, but more importantly, how we shift the political center of the debate to make common sense the progressive values that were, in fact, the dominant parameters for what's right and wrong in politics from 1932 until the mid-70s.
Right, the things that were common sense during my father's generation. And,
absolutely.
And, you know, it's the generation of people who came of age in the 30s and 40s.
And I think the number one thing we got to do is people have to, as the title says, stand up straight and talk about our values. We can't be allowing the right to define the terms of what's right and wrong. So, that, for instance, when it comes to something like the minimum wage, we ought not to accept that when they say, gee whiz, if you pass increases in minimum wage laws, you're going to interfere with the natural laws of how wages should be set. Nothing natural about those laws. Supply and demand is not... is not the arbiter of what people are worth. We're not commodities, corn or beans.
Right. And, well, not only that, that begs the question of, is the economy here to serve society, or is society here to serve those who own the economy or who have the greatest influence in the economy? In fact, one of our callers earlier made a quote from A.J. Liebling that I had never heard before, and I'm assuming that it was accurate. And she said that he had said, you're familiar with him, the newspaper columnist and,
right.
and commentator on critic of the media, as it were, from the previous generation. That he had said that when newspapers report labor disputes, they never say labor is offering to work for $6 an hour, but management is fighting to only pay them $4 an hour.
Right.
Instead, they say management is offering $4 an hour, but labor is fighting or holding out for $6. You know, it's the verbs are always used in a way that makes labor the aggressor and management the victim of that aggression, essentially.
Right, and that setting of the frame is critical to this whole deal. I mean, when after the last election, 2004, we were really in the worst shape we've been in many, many years. Right? I mean, they ran the presidency, the House, and the Senate. Then came the president's attempt to try and privatize Social Security, and essentially assault this sector of the political economy. It's really built on progressive values. We're all in this together, not all in this alone. And
right.
and I think we've successfully turned that back, partially by the way we framed the debate. It was about guaranteed benefits. It was about privatization. They wanted to name it about personal accounts and freedom. We won that framing debate.
Right.
And I think that's a model for how we've got to win the debates going forward into the next into 2009. I got to tell you, though, Tom, I believe we're on the precipice of what could be a fundamental generational realignment in American politics if we win this election big, and then if we go on to deliver in 2009. That's the critical thing. We got to deliver.
Right, which means that we have to have progressive politicians, not Republican light. I mean,
frankly,
right now, Dwight Eisenhower, and I play a lot of clips of Dwight Eisenhower on this show, Dwight Eisenhower was more progressive than a lot of Democratic, big D Democratic Party politicians at this moment.
Absolutely right. Couldn't agree more. And I got to tell you, I'm a big fan of Obama, and in large measure because I think he has the ability to inspire. And to me, what's needed in Washington next year is somebody not just who's a good president. We need somebody who can lead a movement to change Washington, to change the arrangements, the structures of power, and the distribution of resources that characterizes this town for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
And that means somebody's got to go out in the hustings and mobilize the population of the country to do it, because sure as hell it's not going to be done right here in the middle of, the Beltway.
Yeah, and it's also not going to be done from the White House. I mean, regardless of who's the president, it's going to be done at the precinct level, it's going to be done at the county level, it's going to be done at the state level. We have to build a national progressive infrastructure the way that the conservatives have built a national conservative infrastructure that rose up and took over the Republican Party. We need to take back the Democratic Party, in my opinion.
Absolutely right.
So,
go ahead.
So in your book, Listen to Your Mother, Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win, specific suggestions for our listeners.
Well, the book actually is set up both to kind of create the general strategy, but be very specific on steps to be taken with respect to who we communicate with, the kind of messages we have to communicate in order to persuade the persuadables and mobilize the mobilizables. And the one thing I would say that just is enormously important right now, it seems to me, is that the one message that will do both, I mean, there are only two groups of people in politics who, in a campaign or even an issue campaign, that change the outcome, that will change as a result of a campaign. They're persuadable voters who always vote and are flip-floppers, undecided, switch hitters, and there are mobilizable voters who would vote for our cause and our people if they would just get off their rears and go to vote, but it's hard to get them to do that.
Right.
The one message that works with both is inspiration, and it's been the lack of a sense of inspiration since Bob Kennedy died in 1968, I think, that as much as anything has prevented us from inspiring people and getting them to building a majority that it's more than just 50% of the population. I think Obama could do that.
It seems like there are two lines of thought on this, and we only have 30 seconds left. One is that we need inspired leadership and everybody will follow, and the other is that those of us who are the follow need to all get active and the leaders will appear. It sounds like you're saying that both are true.
I think absolutely both are true, and involving, I mean, winning is going to require mobilizing lots and lots of us, normal people all over America, not just good people in Washington.
And then, you know, finding among us those who can stand up and speak the truth like Franklin Roosevelt did, who was a very actually unlikely guy to be speaking those truths in 1936.
All true.
Robert Creamer, his book, Listen to Your Mother, Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. Thank you, Robert.
I like the way you say that, Tom. Thanks much, buddy.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Franklin Roosevelt, coming up next.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
Our people in this country, we work hard every day. Not for fame or fortune do they strive, but the fruits of their labor are worth more than their pay. And it's time a few of them were recognized. Hello, Detroit auto worker. Let me thank you for your time. You work for 40 hours for
the royalists I have spoken of, the royalists of the economic order, have conceded that political freedom was the business of the government, but they have maintained that economic slavery was nobody's business. They granted that the government could protect the citizen in his right to vote, but they denied that the government could do anything to protect the citizen in his right to work and his right to live.
Franklin Roosevelt, 75 years ago, I think it was this week, earlier this week, that he was inaugurated. And speaking of labor, our labor segment for the week, Terry O'Sullivan, the president of the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA, liuna.org is the website, is with us. Hey, Terry.
How you doing, Tom? Always great to be with you. Proud to represent 500,000 hardworking men and women that, as the song says, work hard every day to make this a better country.
There you go. There you go. And we've been talking about this throughout the whole program today, how, you know, conservatives recalibrate this, how they say, oh, we're offering jobs. And it's like, no, sorry, we're willing to work and you can make more money than our labor generates. I mean, even in my case, I mean, with this radio show, if the network makes more money than I do, then they stay in business. I mean, that's the thing. They offer me, it's not that they're offering me a job, it's that I'm giving them a product. And it's the same thing. It's somebody working on an assembly line. They are giving their labor, or they're selling their labor to that company, and that company is then going to sell the fruit of that labor for more than they paid for it, and that's how you make a profit in America. You don't create jobs. You hire people. You basically, I mean, you could argue, I mean, the socialists have for a long time, that you exploit labor.
Workers aren't looking for handouts, as you said, Tom. Yeah. They add value. To me, the most important asset that we have as a country, with all due respect, isn't Wall Street. It's not corporate America. It's working men and women. It is, in fact, workers that provide the profits, produce the profits, and we need a better balance in this country between employees and employers, and that's what organized labor stands for.
Amen. And LIUNA is now, you're talking about the need to rebuild our national infrastructure.
This is a multi-pronged issue, Tom. I mean, we're facing a lot of important issues in this country, but first and foremost, from our perspective, America needs politicians who believe in taking care of the basics, who believe in building America. What's happening to our transportation infrastructure in this country, really, the neglect is a crime. I mean, when you think about in 2005, Hurricane Katrina, when 1,400 people died because levees failed, and still today there are 3,500 dams across America that are unsafe. You've talked about it. We've talked about it before last August. We saw what happens if you don't take care of the basics. when the I-35 bridge collapsed in Minneapolis, right, where 13 people died and 100 were injured. And still today, one out of four bridges in America is structurally deficient or functionally obsolete. And these statistics are telling, and what happens is that this is affecting the quality of life. It's affecting people's lives.
But the response to this of folks like John McCain is, well, then let's just privatize those things. Let's turn them over to private corporations and let them, you know, put a toll thing up there and charge for it. That's what Indiana's doing right now.
And a lot of other places, too. And I do believe this, Tom, I think that there is a role for privatization, a role. But it is not the solution to rebuilding and expanding the transportation right. infrastructure.
Especially when they're privatizing it to Spanish and French companies.
That's right.
I mean, make me crazy. No, take the profits to Europe, right?
That's right. I think state government, federal government, we all have responsibilities as Americans, as citizens. Yeah. And certainly there needs to be a balance between alternative approaches for expansion and repair of our transportation infrastructure. But that is not an excuse for the federal government or state governments to shirk their responsibilities to provide safe roads and bridges in this country.
So, Terry, as an observer of the political scene, presidencies of McCain versus either Obama or Clinton for labor?
I think there's no comparison. I mean, John McCain, with all due respect, I do believe he's an American hero, and I think anybody that wears the uniforms of the armed services is an American hero, but he is no hero for working families in this country. John McSame is what we would end up with. We're going to have an extension of what's happened to us under George W. Bush for the last 8 years. He does not support a worker's right to join or form a union, doesn't support the Employee Free Choice Act. He has voted 15 times since 1983 against Davis-Bacon, which is near and dear to our members' heart. This guy is not a friend of working families. Both Senator Obama and Senator Clinton do support the Employee Free Choice Act. They support transportation infrastructure spending. So there is no comparison between Senator McCain or Senator Obama and Senator Clinton.
An important point that needs to be made over and over and over again. Terry O'Sullivan, the president of LIUNA, LIUNA.org. Thanks, Terry.
Always great being with you, Tom.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Let me take.
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Looks like Elliot Spitzer is going to have a bit of a problem on his hands. This link to a prostitution ring is the headline of the New York Times. We'll see how this plays out. We'll just leave it at that for the moment. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Tom in Washington State, listening on KPTK. Hey, Tom, what's up?
You know, you've had a pretty level-headed look at the race between Obama and Clinton, so I wanted to get your take on this. It seems to me, with the comments she's made recently, that she's willing to put her own ambitions ahead of the party's chance at the White House. She suggested that McCain would be better prepared to be president than Obama. She suggested that he isn't ready, and yet she says that she'd put him on the ticket as a VP. If the country was her concern, you'd put forward a VP candidate that is ready to step in on day one.
Yeah, this was the essence of the riff that I did about a week ago, where I talked about in therapy or in counseling or in just in relationships, there's this concept of the belt line. You don't hit below the belt line. You know, we all know if we are in a relationship with somebody over time, you get to know where people's belt lines are. You get to know the things that you can say to them that will actually wound them, that you can't take back, you know. and that, in my opinion, Barack Obama has not hit Hillary Clinton below the belt line, although he could. And Hillary Clinton has hit Barack Obama below the belt line on at least two occasions. And those are woundings that you can't take back, and they're woundings that are going to harm him as a nominee for president or as a nominee for vice president. And I think it's just bad politics. I think that frankly makes sense to me. And I think it's hurting Hillary Clinton as well. I mean, she is tarnishing herself, and I hope that she's doing this on the advice of bad advisors. I hope that this is not a reflection of her real personality, that rather what we're seeing here is, you know, Mark Penn or something like that, because this is just, it's just wrong. And, you know, to play the game that way, you just don't do that. And so we'll see. We'll see how it plays out. Mark in New Mexico. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom. At the risk of sounding picky, I have to correct Mr. Kramer on one point. Robert Kennedy didn't die. He was assassinated.
You're right.
And one of the topics of the day is poisoned waters. And I know when you get to Darfur, if you don't already know, that that is one of the favorite tactics of the Janjaweed bandits who are trying to kill off...
Right, it's poisoning the wells in the communities.
Poisoning the wells. And in America, we have this problem too, but in New Mexico, we're actually jealous of you big city folks who get free mood-altering drugs and
in our water supplies
and anti-anxiety medications, because all we get in our water is plutonium and PCBs and mercury and perchlorate.
Right.
And it's kind of like Marilyn Monroe said, we get the fuzzy end of the lollipop.
Yeah, there you go, Mark. Thanks a lot. Very strange. Gary in Pittsburgh. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. Have a safe trip, by the way.
Thank you.
Two observations, if I may. Number one is, and it's my own personal opinion, I believe, hopefully, that Barack Obama will be our next president, but I believe he will pick, and I would, too, I would pick Bill Richardson as my vice president's pick, and I'm going to tell you why. He's a former candidate with great name recognition, but more than that, he's respected on both sides of the political aisle, Republican and Democrat, obviously. He's a governor. And he'll bring, he'll pick up a lot of the Hispanic vote that, Senator Obama would ordinarily pick up. Yeah, and even George Bush picked him up for a post in government.
Yeah. So I think, Bill, I was always kind of wishy-washy about Bill Richardson because I have friends who live in New Mexico. I'm on the air in New Mexico, and I get, you know, feedback about that. And some folks have said, well, you know, he's not really all that progressive and, you know, quack, quack, quack. And I met him in New Hampshire, and I realized that, you know, the power of charm, you have to try to, you know, it's like I met Bill Clinton, too. And in fact, I introduced him in Seattle, Washington, about a year and a half ago for a fundraiser for Jim McDermott. And for 5 minutes, I was convinced that Bill Clinton thought I was his best friend in the world. I mean, you know, that's how incredibly charming this guy is. But with Bill Richardson, just sitting and talking with him, this is a really solid guy. I mean, this is he really does know his stuff, and he really does have the background, and maybe he's had to make some legislative calls that I wouldn't have made or that I didn't like because I didn't think that they were progressive enough. But I'm assuming that that's just, you know, in politics, sometimes you have to compromise. I agree with you. I think that Bill Richardson would make a great vice presidential candidate for Barack Obama, or for Hillary Clinton, for that matter. And frankly, as I've been saying all along, I don't think that he was ever seriously running for president. I think all along he's been running for vice president. So
I agree. I have one more. Right. Yeah. I agree. I have one more remark, if I may. For two elections here, we've been our own worst enemy. The last two elections, and we elected the worst president of my lifetime. And it seems to me that we can't afford to go into this. We can't afford to make a wrong decision again. And we need more national character, if you will, in picking presidents.
Yeah. No, I absolutely, Gary, good point. But, you know, here we are, and this is what we have, and we're going to have to make a decision. And it's going to be the voters who are going to make the decision. And then we need to get together and move this party in an appropriate direction. Over the short term toward victory, over the long term toward a progressive majority. Anne Marie in Canton, Michigan. Hey, Anne Marie.
Hi, how
are you, Tom?
I'm fine. I'm great, but I'll get better.
Oh, good, good. Hopefully, like people in Michigan, too. Right now, as you know, we're all mad at the Detroit DNC because of our votes. And,
right.
In the middle of this great economic mess that we're in here. But
yeah.
I've been with the League of Women Voters for about 15 years, and I've moderated forums, and I've, you know, interviewed candidates from all genres. And I have to tell you, about 12 years ago, the House Republicans in the state, they went and they gerrymandered all the districts to change
mm-hmm.
them so that, they'd be mostly Republican. And what's happening here is the progressives that are trying to run, when they go to the DNC, they're being told, unless you can come up with, you know, this much million, you know, we can't even look at you.
Right.
And they're not helping them. I mean, Nancy Skinner and Royal Oak had to pull out because, I mean, she was the closest. She almost beat the Republican in the last race. And instead of the DNC helping her, they basically said, hey, I'm sorry, you can't pull in the millions we need. And so, you know, we need another candidate. So it's not even enough that you stand up and say something because you can't raise the money. And
yeah, and my good friend Tony Trupiano, also in Detroit, banged his head against that wall in the last election cycle.
Right.
Yeah, and that's the unfortunate political reality, and it's why we need to be, you know, I mean, it's at this moment, what we are seeing is not just a battle for the heart and soul of America, you know, for the future of America, but quite literally a battle for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. And it's why we need to be engaged and we need to be participating right now. And the extent to which the Democratic Party doesn't respond to us and doesn't listen to us is the extent to which we need to infiltrate it and take it over and be involved. So,
right.
Anne-Marie, thank you very much for your advocacy and for your hard work and for getting out there. Eddie in Greenfield, Massachusetts, listening to WHMP. Hey, Eddie. Eddie?
Hello.
You're on the air.
Tom.
Yeah.
Hey, are you better now?
I am.
I wanted to comment on what a couple of your callers talked about just before you switched to the FDR thing.
Mm-hmm.
One was about newspaper reporting.
Right, the media coverage of labor.
Right. The best one I can think of is when Harry Bridges, the West Coast Longshoremen's leader years ago,
mm-hmm.
Was interviewed by a reporter. And what he said was, I have yet to read a newspaper that's ever taken the side of the workers.
Well, actually, you know, when I was a kid, back in the days when I was, you know, I was born in 51. And when I was a kid in Michigan, there was a labor paper and there was a business paper. There's the Detroit Free Press, the Detroit News. And one had a labor section and one had a business section. One was reliably Democratic. One was reliably Republican. And you could pick which one you wanted to read. And you get the news of interest to one side or the other.
Yeah, make an opinion.
Yeah, it used to be that way all over America. Eddie, I got to drop the call. Thank you for the call, but the echo is making me crazy. That's the wonder of media diversity. That's when you've got a lot of newspapers that are locally owned, that are responsive to the community, and now you end up with one statewide newspaper that's owned out of some other state someplace else, and they try to say, oh, we're in the middle. We're walking down the middle. Or we're showing both sides. But I haven't seen a labor section in a newspaper for at least half my lifetime. Steven in Mountain View, California. Hey, Steven, got to take a break here in about a half a minute. What's up?
Oh, it's a short message. Tom, I've been calling my senators are Boxer and Feinstein. My
mm-hmm.
Representative is Eshoo. They're all fine people, but I've been calling them about once a week, maybe every other week, for 2 years, and it doesn't seem to make a big difference. In fact, I get
keep
a lot
at
of,
it. Keep at
I get
it.
A lot of, well, I get a lot of email back from them, and it's about stuff that I didn't actually talk to them about, so
yeah.
It doesn't sound like they're listening.
Well, here the key, Stephen, and Bernie Sanders talks about this. Make one single point in one single sentence. Don't try to educate them. Don't try to give them a whole long thing. Don't send them 35 pages of something. Make one point when you call. Make it very, very simple, and make every call separate. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. The true people's radio.
Tom Hartman.
I hope the days come easy and the moments pass slow. And each road leads you where you want to go. And if you're faced with a choice and you have to choose, I I hope you choose the one that means the most to you. And if one door opens to another door closed, I hope you keep on walking till you find the window. If it's cold outside, show the world the warmth of your smile. But more than anything, my wish for you is that this life becomes all that you want it to. You
and the democracy returns to America. Franklin Roosevelt speaking out.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America.
Yeah, that's what they complain about.
What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power.
Spot on, Franklin.
Our allegiance. And our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
I think in the Declaration of Independence it was, it is your duty to overthrow that kind of power. Franklin, this is from his 1936 acceptance speech in Philadelphia, as I recall.
In vain, they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution.
Yeah, with those little flag lapel pins, yeah.
But in their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for.
Let's see. They don't stand for mob rule, and they don't stand for the overprivileged.
Now, as always, for over a century and a half, the flag, the Constitution, stand against a dictatorship by mob rule and the overprivileged alike. And the flag and the Constitution stand for democracy, not tyranny. For freedom, not subjection.
There you go, Franklin Roosevelt. 52 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Roy in Culver City, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Roy, what's up?
Hello, Tom. A pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
The fellow you had on this morning with the barroom economics.
Yeah.
I think his...
Al Perinello.
Yes, his whole argument is specious, and here's why I think that. He says that 1% of the population pays 37% of the taxes. There's no correlation there. What I'd like to know is how much money does that 1% earn?
Yeah, or how much wealth do they own? Ken sent me a rebuttal to the Barstool economics thing, which I think pretty much everybody's seen, so I won't recite that. But here's the rebuttal. The 10 men drank in the bar every day and seemed okay with the arrangement until one day the richest man decided he didn't like the plan anymore. He said, I can't believe I've been paying $59 for beer while four of you are getting your beers for free. I think we should all pay a flat price for beer, so I'm only going to pay $10 from now on. Without the 10th man's money, the poorest 5 men couldn't afford to go to the bar every day, so they only came in occasionally from then on. The 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th men stuck with the arrangement, and the 4 of them still had a good time drinking together every day. They missed their old friends, the poor guys who couldn't come anymore, and they were mad at the richest man, who eventually stopped coming because he had nobody to talk to. But now we get to the nub of it. The bartender, who used to be making $100 a day, is now only making $40 a day, and soon he had to take out a loan just to keep the bar open. Eventually, he couldn't pay the loans back, and the bar had to close. The 10 men, now down to 4, went their separate way. The richest man had saved himself a lot of money, but his rigid lack of selflessness cost him his 9 best friends and his favorite bar, which many people consider to be the greatest bar in the world, was gone forever. So, you know, it's like taking it out to the commons.
Yeah. It's like the analogy that if Bill Gates walked into a room with 50 bums, then everybody in that room, on an average, would be worth $1 billion.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Good point. Good point, Roger. Thanks a lot for the call and making it. I appreciate it. Chip in L.A. Hey, Chip.
Hi. About a week ago, a little over a week ago, Ralph Nader was on your program.
Yes, he was.
And he brought up the idea of a congressional watchdog lobby,
mm-hmm.
where he wants to get, his goal is to get 1,000 people in each district, in every district in the country.
Right.
to work toward a common goal.
Yep.
Of things like single-payer health care and against corporate greed.
Mm-hmm.
And this just struck me as a great idea that somebody like Ralph Nader, an iconic figure, could be the one person in the country that could bring together an organization like this that could work on a daily basis to...
Yeah, I'd much rather see him do that than run for president. Good point, Chip. Thank you very much. Jody in Tacoma. Hey, Jody.
Oh, hi, Tom. Real quick before you have to get off, the last caller you were talking about having Bill Richardson as a possible VP.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think it would do if Barack actually put somebody like Richardson on the ticket now and kind of preempt all that talk that Hillary's doing with him as her vice president?
My guess is that he would be seen as trying to do a political maneuver against Hillary Clinton, and that it would backfire on him. I think that it would probably be, you know, at the level of the voter, it might be a really good idea, because essentially what Hillary is running on right now is that Barack is going to be her vice president. That's what her husband is out there saying. That's what she's been saying. And so when people go to the polls now, they think that they're voting for a Clinton-Obama ticket. I mean, in my opinion, that's the strategy that Mark Penn has laid out, is to tie her to Obama, to tie her to all his positives, while at the same time holding up his negatives. How does Obama rebut that? I think the only thing he can do is just say, no, I'm not going to be vice president. But I don't think that he can name his own vice president, just like I don't think she should have named him as her vice president. I think it's a mistake. It's not good for the party. Tomorrow, Sam Cedar. Wednesday, Thursday, Laura Flanders. Peter and Carl Wolfson will be here on Friday. Peter B. Collins, Monday, Tuesday next week. I'll be back in the studio on the 19th, plus the best of the rest of your calls here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there and get active. We'll see you in a week.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.